Anya's attention was drawn to a tableau in the street below. Leaning over a concrete balustrade, she made out three voices. The woman's voice was young, contralto. Just from its pitch and flow, it was clearly as educated as the men's speech was rough. It was also very familiar.
Easy and Gwenya.
Anya crouched to reduce her visibility from below. The three didn't seem to have noticed her. Easy stood with feet apart, just more than shoulder width. She wore a long black leather coat that looked expensive. Easy's hands were on her hips, under the tails of the long coat, hiking them up. The two men, who were dressed much like the men Anya had just tangled with, showed no sign of awareness of what she was about.
No!
The men's hands moved quickly and decisively. The man on Easy's left shouted. His partner lunged suddenly for her from what he seemed to think was her blind spot. Metal glinted in his hand in the light of a street lamp a block away. Easy's right hand came out. The man staggered and sagged. The other man tried to move. He dropped his knife and reached back in his peacoat. Easy straight-armed the pistol. The man collapsed. Easy now turned her head toward the man on her right, who was still on his feet and waving what Anya took for a knife. Easy straightened her right arm, sighted quickly. The man pitched onto his face. The knife bounced on the sidewalk. His hands scrabbled at the pavement, spasmed once, went still. Easy was walking away, briskly but not hastily, tucking her matched weapons back into their holsters. Anya let out a long breath she hadn't realized she was keeping in. She hurried down the steps. No lights showed on any of the upper floors on the two nearby blocks. This was not the choicest neighborhood in the city. Residents might be somewhat accustomed to the sound of nearby gunfire. They were not likely to call the police. Anya rushed to the nearest man. Easy had shot him in the face. He lay sprawled on his back, arms flung out. She towed gingerly at the front of his peacoat. It slid aside enough to reveal a glimpse of dark metal and checked rubber. He carried a pistol in a shoulder rig. It was all she needed to know. She picked a different direction from the one Easy had taken and walked away fast without appearing to hurry. It was fast enough. No one stopped her. The center of Paris itself is tiny and can be walked around in a day, despite the vast and expanding dreary suburbs surrounding it. Walking to her hotel at a more leisurely pace, Anya breathed deeply into her abdomen and tried to bring her thoughts under control. She had just killed three men. No matter how justified that was, she had vowed she would never take that lightly. She had also seen two more men killed with ruthless efficiency. Anya had bumped into notorious pot hunter and media personality Easy Ungwenya three times in her life in person, and two of those encounters had come in the past 36 hours. In that time span, six people had died in close proximity to the two of them. One, Sir Sidney, had been brutally murdered. The others appeared to have been trying to kill, in one case Anya, in the other Ungwenya.
What's going on?
Of one thing she was certain. Those had not been standard street muggings. Anya's assailants had been hired assassins, but Easy's? Walking through the lights and the camera-flashing throngs of the Champs-Élysées, Anya had little doubt all five would-be assassins had been cut from the same cloth. Hard men, but not street criminal hard. Pro-hard. Something in the way her own attackers moved suggested to Anya they had been ex-military. Such men didn't do such work for cheap.
Well, Easy's rich, isn't she?
It all came back to the golden elephant. Was it possible they were after the same thing? When Anya had barely learned of the thing's existence, had yet to verify it really did exist, what else could explain all the coincidences, not to mention the sudden attacks? In her hotel room, a modest establishment not far from the Tuileries, with only moderately ruinous rates, Anya sat back and ran her hands across her face and back through her heavy chestnut hair. Her notebook computer lay open before her crossed legs, propped on a pillow so the cooling fan exhaust wouldn't scorch her bare thighs. She had been doing research not just on the Golden Elephant. A quick check of her email accounts showed no helpful responses to a number of guarded queries she'd fired off to contacts across the world, but also on the elephant calf. Princess Easy herself. She was a martial artist, model, scholar, pot hunter. There was a quote from an interview with the German magazine Der Spiegel that jumped out at Anya.
To be sure, I'm rich and multi-talented, but that has nothing to do with me. Those are circumstances. I prefer to focus on my achievements.
Anya rocked back on the bed, frowning. She badly wanted to toss that off as spoiled little rich girl arrogance. Arrogant it was, but at base it made sense. And Elephant Calf Anguena had achievements. She had even been a celebrity as a little girl. National Geographic had done a spread on the official celebration of the birth of a royal first child of one of Africa's most powerful tribes, and again on the party her father had thrown for her fifth birthday. Her father was technically the chief of a tribe of South Africa's Zulu nation and an outspoken critic of the ANC-dominated government. Repeated attempts had been made on his life. During one incident, the then 15-year-old Princess Elephant Calf had killed two would-be assassins with two shots from a colonial-era double-barreled elephant gun. In the subsequent furor, the world media missed the fact that the recoil from the first shot of the monstrous gun had broken Easy's shooting hand. Yet she had coolly lined up a second shot and blown a hole in an adult male wielding a Kalashnikov. Anya had to nod her head to that. Spoiled little rich girl she might be, but she was the real deal. Less than a year later, Elephant Calf left home for good. She had gone on to earn multiple degrees from some of the world's most esteemed institutions. She'd carved out a reputation as an adventuress. She was outspoken in defending what academic archaeologists dismissed as pot hunting.
The majority of artifacts recovered go straight away into the basements of universities and government-run museums, where they lie gathering dust. If they're not mislabeled or lost due to incompetence, or thrown out as a result of budget cuts, or stolen by government officials, all of which happens far more than the academic world lets on.
Anya shook her head. What Easy said was true enough, but it was only part of the story. She failed to mention sites plundered by profit-driven pot hunters, priceless context destroyed and lost forever, provenance muddied, and of course, indigenous peoples robbed of their cultural heritage.
She's one of the bad guys. She's behind all these killings, even if they did blow up in her pretty little face.
Anya ran her eyes back up the page of the Italian Antiquities Journal she was reading. It dated from the spring of 1936, during the heart of Italy's bungled incursion into Ethiopia. Anya was skimming an article on discoveries by the French in the Cambodian sector of their Indo-Chinese Empire, in which the author felt compelled to mention the infrequent German efforts in the region. Suddenly, her awareness snapped to the phrase, German Southeast Asian Expedition of 1913 to 1914. Her gaze whipped back up the column of the time-yellowed page. And there it was, the phrase that had belatedly snagged her attention, which continued, led by Professor Rudolf von Heunigen of the University of Berlin.
Yes!
She pumped her fist in the air beside her and smiled happily at the glares her outburst earned her.
Excuse me. Aren't you Anya Cree?
Anya couldn't place the voice or the accent. That was unusual. She looked up from her croissant. She blinked. The speaker was tall, lean, immaculately dressed, without being overdressed. His hair was dark and slicked back on his fine, aristocratic head. His cream-colored jacket was thrown casually over one shoulder. His eyes were dark and long-lashed, his features fine, yet thoroughly masculine.
I beg your pardon.
I am a fan of yours. Both your yeoman service on chasing history's monsters and your more serious work.
Anya managed to avoid having either to clear her throat or gulp her coffee to speak intelligibly.
Really?
If you'll forgive the forwardness, please allow me to introduce myself. I am Giancarlo Scarlatti Salas, a colleague, at least in the scientific realm. I am an archaeologist myself. I received my degree from the National University of Córdoba, in Argentina, my homeland. I did my graduate work at the University of Padua.
That's in the humid Pampa, isn't it? Land of the Comechigón people.
Spoken like an archaeologist. The average person would no doubt have said, land of the gauchos. If she even recognized the word Pampa, May I sit?
Oh, where are my manners? Sure. Yes, please.
You seemed a bit preoccupied when I noticed you. I'm here doing research into recent progress being made in translating the great hoard of documents from the ancient kingdom of Tombuctu.
Oh, yes. I've heard of that. It's outside my area, but seems tremendously exciting.
Oh, quite. But if you'll forgive my noticing, you seem perhaps a bit excited yourself.
Anya hadn't known it was that obvious. She almost blushed.
You must have just learned something remarkable.
She sat a moment. Then she leaned forward and rested her elbows on the table.
I'm trying to track down an early 20th century German expedition into Indochina.
Indochina? Not where Germans usually went in those days.
Not at all, as far as I can tell. Then again, I've had an incredibly hard time finding any mention of it whatsoever. What's got me worked up is that I was finally able to put a name to it. The von Heuningen expedition of 1913.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. I have yet to turn up anything more on the expedition, but at least now I know I'm on reasonably solid ground. For a while there, I wasn't sure the expedition really happened.
I see. You must be most gratified. Do you mind if I ask, does your interest arise from your work on the show or your own researches?
Both. I'm afraid I'd better not say anything more about it because of that. The network's legal department is meticulous about their non-disclosure agreements.
Ah, lawyers. I understand.
Salas sat a moment, looking distracted. His elevated foot swung slightly to and fro.
I work mostly in Mediterranean and South American archaeology, but something about the name seems to tweak my memory. If I were to be able to provide you a further lead, would you be able to tell me what all this mystery is about?
Sure. If you're willing to wait until the show is either shot and scheduled or the proposal gets shot down.
None of that was exactly untrue.
If I get a paper out of it, I'll be happy to credit you.
That would be most kind. And now, if you'll excuse me, I won't take up any more of your valuable research time. It's been a delight meeting you, Miss Creed. May I offer you my card?
Anya fumbled in the day pack she wore.
Oh, yes. And here's mine, too. It's got my cell number. In case you remember anything about Rudolf von Heuningen, you know.
To be sure.
Anya extended her hand. Salas took it in both of his, bent over it, and lightly pressed his lips to it. Then, with a last smile, turned and strode off. Anya stood looking after him, goosebumps all over, wondering if this was what it felt like to be asked to the prom, and feeling like a damned fool for feeling that way. The sound of her cell phone trilled Anya awake. She groped for it on the nightstand and knocked it to the floor.
Damn.
Fortunately, it bounced on the throw rug next to the bed. Finally, she found the phone and fell back into bed.
Anya.
Splendid. It's Giancarlo. Giancarlo Scarlatti. We met today?
I remember. Hi, Giancarlo. What's up?
I may have something for you. I remembered where I heard about Professor Dr. von Heuningen.
Anya suddenly sat up straight.
What?
I believe I know somebody who can help you.
Out of the traffic, a remarkable figure materialized. An obviously female rider, with a colorful polycarbonate mushroom of a helmet and a UV-blocking face shield. She was dressed in a dark burgundy sweater, gray culottes, stockings that matched her sweater, and gray athletic shoes. She sat at ease in what appeared to be a mesh lawn chair atop two wheels, pedaling serenely with feet secured by black straps. The apparition held her arms by her sides, steering by means of handles jutting to the sides below the level of the seat. The vehicle negotiated its way deftly through the traffic to the curb. The rider disengaged her shoes from the pedal straps, clambered out of the seat, hauled the unlikely-looking bicycle up onto the sidewalk, and wheeled it to the rack. She locked it in place, then took a shoulder bag from the rack behind the seat. Unstrapping the helmet, she walked toward the door. As she pushed into the little pastry shop where Anya sat, she shook out a head full of gleaming wine-red hair. Her eyes lit on Anya. Beaming, she strode forward, helmet tucked under her arm like a medieval knight.
But you must be Anya Creed.
She was tall, Anya discovered as she stood up politely, no more than an inch or two shorter than Anya herself. She had that sort of lush tautness Anya associated with French women.
At close range, as Anya shook her proffered hand, finding her grip strong and cool, she could see the woman's red hair was laced with a few silver strands.
And you must be Dr. Gendron. So pleased to meet you.
Oh, Isabelle, please. We are not Germans, after all.
Interesting you should mention Germans in titles. But I thought national distinctions were supposed to dissolve over time in the European Union.
Oh, many things are supposed to happen. I understand that in America, where children put lost teeth under their pillows, the tooth fairy is supposed to bring them money. Alexander, Napoleon, Hitler. Aside from being destructive monsters, what are those men in common?
They all tried to unify Europe?
Bon, you do know history. Instead of just the pretty lies that are so often told in its place. But enough of events beyond our means to affect. I'm hungry.
She picked up a menu. Anya sipped her coffee as the professor fished a pair of reading glasses from inside her sweater and perched them on her fine, narrow nose. The waitress came. Both women ordered pastries.
I can see why the professor does it, riding that bike everywhere. I'll have to run around the whole city to work off the starch overload.
Gendron crossed her legs and leaned forward when the menus had been surrendered.
So, Gianni tells me you've a question about some antique German expedition.
How do you know him?
Giancarlo studied under me for a time.
He must have enjoyed it. I actually read one of your books as a textbook my freshman year. Dynamite and Dreams, a survey of pre-20th century archaeology. I found it fascinating. A delightful surprise, I have to tell you.
I hate it when my students fall asleep on me. I'll try not to let that make me feel old, that you read my book as a schoolgirl.
In college. It wasn't that long ago.
I'm just having you on, as the English say. Now, what was it you wanted to know?
Whatever you can tell me about Rudolf von Heuningen and his expedition to Indochina.
He came of East Prussian nobility, reduced to genteel poverty by Bismarck's German unification. He appears to have burned up what remained of his inheritance to finance his 1913 expedition. Rudolf was a gay, apolitical, physical culture buff, obsessed with the mystic knowledge of the ancient Buddhists and Taoists. He was also a premier archaeological explorer of his day, very progressive in his refusal to rely upon dynamite, a staple of the time, as the title of my textbook reminds us. He apparently met with great success, as his letters back to the University of Berlin attest. The few that survived the bombardments of the Second World War. But when it came time to return home, he faced a difficulty.
World War I?
The waitress delivered their pastries.
Yes. Owing to British control of the Suez Canal, von Heuningen was forced to travel an arduous, dangerous, circuitous land route. He had to travel up through China to the ancient Silk Road, then through Turkestan into Turkey. Having survived all that, he loaded his specimens and journals onto a ship, the freighter Hensau, and set sail from Istanbul. Whereupon a British submarine lurking in the Sea of Marmara promptly torpedoed it.
Oh dear.
The explosion killed poor Rudolf outright. The captain, thinking fast, managed to ground his ship in shallow water. Von Heuningen's assistant, Erich Dessauer, who may or may not have been his lover, recovered a few of his artifacts and journals. The assistant made his way back to Germany with as many journals and crates of artifacts as he could, intending to send for the rest later. Instead, he was promptly drafted and died in the British tank attack at Cambrai in 1918. Most of what he brought home vanished in the Second World War. What survives remains in the Istanbul University collection.
That's quite the litany of disasters.
Almost enough to make one believe the expedition was cursed. But we know there are no such things as curses, yes?
Sure.
A Turkish researcher stumbled across the bare facts of the lost von Heuningen expedition in the middle 50s. In the 70s, much of the story was pieced together by a writer for American Adventure magazines. In 1997, scholars substantiated the American's account and filled in the gaps. In the modern archaeological world, the doomed von Heuniken expedition is remembered, to the minor extent it is at all, more as a cautionary tale about the dangers and disappointments of the archaeological life than for its science.
I'd imagine. Thank you so much.
So, why the interest in this most obscure of misadventures? You don't seem to have the taste for others' misfortunes.
Not at all. Recently, I've been given hints of important cultural relics the Germans found. Perhaps even a vast temple complex which has yet to be rediscovered.
A lost temple? In this day and age? Still, I read every now and again of such things being found around the world with the help of satellites and aircraft.
It's a tantalizing possibility. Whether or not it's more than that, well, that's what I'd like to find out.
To be sure. What archaeologist worth her whip and revolver wouldn't want to be the one to discover a grand new lost temple?
It is with very great pleasure that I am able to place the Istanbul Archaeology Museum at the disposal of so distinguished a peer as Miss Anya Creed.
The curator led her through the dimly lit exhibition hall. He was a huge, fat man with a bandit mustache, tapering shaven head, and dark, wiry stubble on his olive jowls. Ahmet Baseli looked like the stereotypical evil Turk from Central Casting. He was, in fact, a cheerful, gentle-voiced scholar of enormous international repute. He was curator of special collections for the museum and overflowing with enthusiasm. Anya looked into a case of Byzantine coins so he wouldn't see her slight grimace.
Is it because I'm really such a notable archaeologist, or because I play one on TV?
Still, enough lay at stake that she needed to swallow her ego and go with what worked. Again, she wasn't deceiving the man. She was just taking a hit to her pride. Again.
It's so good of you to allow me access to the von Heuniken collection, Dr. Baseli.
Please understand that it is meager and incomplete.
I gathered as much from my previous research. But believe me, Doctor, anything will help. Even if it's only something to peer at through glass.
Istanbul was a modern city, so big and boisterous and full of history that a single continent wouldn't hold it. Anya loved visiting here. The city was surprisingly green. Although the green was turning rapidly sere with the onset of a chilly autumn, winter was a ways off yet, but the autumn was damp and cool enough for her. She didn't have time for sightseeing. She felt driven. She sensed other forces moving around her, probably including Easy Anguena. That made it urgent to find the truth about the von Heuniken expedition. And if there was anything to the rumors of a fabulous temple lost in the jungle, with its appropriately fabulous treasure, she had to find and secure them before the plunderers arrived like a plague of locusts. The looming, vaguely conical mass of her guide halted by a case of small artifacts displayed against a cream silk backdrop.
Here you see such artifacts as we possess. Von Heuniken's assistant lacked the means to carry them with him back to Germany. His misfortune proved a blessing for archaeology. No doubt you are aware the bulk of the artifacts he saved from the sunken Henzau were destroyed in the Allied bombing of Berlin in World War II.
Anya nodded.
Even though expeditions are notoriously prone to catastrophe, I have seldom, if ever, heard of such a collection of calamities as befell the von Heuniken expedition. It is almost enough to make one believe in a curse.
But you don't, do you?
Of course not. Especially a curse by infidels. That would be mere superstition.
Baseli rather grandly produced a set of keys and opened the case's glass cover. He gestured for Anya to examine what she would.
Not much to see.
Anya pulled on the pair of non-latex medical-style gloves he had provided her. A few coins, a few small carvings and castings, a lacquer medallion. One object caught her eye. She reached in and gingerly picked up an elephant figurine no bigger than the palm of her hand, in verdigrised bronze. Its workmanship was exquisite. It stood with trunk curled to forehead and mouth open. It almost seemed to be smiling.
Ah, that catches your eye as well. There is something to it, some quality I cannot put my finger upon. It has been rumored since Dessauer's departure that it is the replica of a larger statue of pure gold to which von Heunigen referred in his notes. Sadly, we do not have these notes. It is why we exhibit these items as relics of the tragic expedition itself, since we cannot authoritatively source them or connect them to specific sites or cultures other than by inference.
Anya handed the figurine back to Baselli.
Thank you. If I could see the surviving notebooks now, please?
Of course.
Anya sat in the dark and cool confines of a private reading room with the journal open before her. To her right lay her computer, connected to the internet via the museum's wireless network. She was typing in promising-looking passages from the journal and then running them through a translation program. The work was tedious, but she plodded on. And then words jumped out at her.
The jungle a mighty temple gave up.
Anya reared back, barely able to believe it. She carefully studied the words surrounding the phrase.
The climb up the plateau was hazardous. We lost two bearers to a mudslide when a rope in a sudden downpour gave way.
She skimmed a few sentences, then read more.
Mm-hmm. The guardians of the temple were cautious. Our guide, Ba, managed to convince them we meant no harm. We only meant honor to the ancients and the Buddha to give.
There followed a matter-of-fact discussion of his dealings with the plateau's inhabitants, who were wary of them. They warmed after the expedition's physician, Dr. Kramer, set a child's broken arm. At last, the visitors got permission to climb a small peak in the center of the plateau.
The special sanctuary, the Holy of Holies. The Temple of the Elephant was colossal. Our hearts were in our throats at the splendor of this marvel, this treasure, this golden elephant with emeralds for eyes. I made complete sketches of the temples and the idol in my sketchbook. Oh, no.
None of that had survived the Hentzau torpedoing.
It can still be found where I found the map. Inscribed on the base of the statue of Avalokiteshvara in the Red Monastery outside Nakhon Sawan in the Kingdom of Siam.
Anya sat back, frowning.
At least there really is a temple and a golden elephant.
Miss Creed?
Anya started and looked up. A painfully earnest young man with a mop of heavy coal-black hair stood respectfully back from her chair.
Yes?
Curator Baselli would like to speak with you in his office immediately, if it is convenient to you.
Certainly.
Anya felt a brief tug of concern over leaving her computer unattended, but the reading room was closed to the public, and Baselli, for all his jovial manner, did not strike Anya as the sort who'd put up with pilferage in his department. She walked briskly back to his office. But when she peeked around the frame of the half-open door, the office was empty. A dreadful certainty she'd been tricked stuck in the base of her throat. She turned and walked back to the reading room as quickly as she could without making a scene that would raise questions she didn't want to answer or leave hanging. Her computer and von Heunigen's open journal still sat on the table. Disappearing out the far door of the long, narrow room, she saw a familiar, expensively clad figure.
Easy.
The figure vanished from sight. Anya sprinted after. She got all the way out into the warm daylight with nothing to show but a wisp of expensive scent. Anya made herself march back to the reading room, neither dashing nor slouching in defeat. Rudolf von Heunigen's aggravating notebook was intact. A surprisingly quick diagnostic reassured her that no nasty software had been quickly and covertly installed on her computer.
But it's not like there's no such thing as a digital camera.
She was sure the little witch of a pot hunter had photographed the relevant pages to translate or digest at her leisure.
Anya! Anya Creed, what a delightful surprise!
On the steps of the museum, Anya stopped and turned at the greeting.
Giancarlo! Well, this is quite a coincidence.
Some might call it kismet, as they do here, come to think of it. I might call it synchronicity. But really, it's not such a great coincidence after all, is it? We share a profession and many particular interests. My researches have brought me to Istanbul. I can only presume you have done the same.
Yes.
Of course, you are a Renaissance scholar.
Salas took her hands in his firm, strong grip. Despite the humid heat off the Bosporus, his palms were dry. She envied him. She herself had been outdoors less than a minute and felt as if she'd just emerged from the shower with her clothes on.
The Turks were the great enemy of Renaissance Europe. So naturally, at some point in your studies, you likewise find yourself here.
He said it with such conviction that she didn't have the heart to disabuse him. She accepted a warm hug and a peck on her cheek.
It's good to see you again, no matter the reason.
Will you join me for a cup of coffee? The coffee here is excellent. But what am I saying? Of course it is. It's Turkey.
Anya had always appreciated a man who could laugh at himself.
So that's where things stand.
Anya sat slumped in a chair in the air-conditioned comfort of a cafe 2 blocks from the museum.
Every clue I find seems just to add another link to the chain. I never seem to get closer. And the most substantial clue I found so far, I just handed to the world's most notorious pot hunter.
Giancarlo nodded sympathetically. He had listened raptly as she poured out her story to him, minus the details of exactly what it was she sought.
Surely it's not so bad, Anya, my dear.
But it is. I think people have been killed over this already.
But you have the information you needed, do you not?
Well, I have leads to follow. And I seem to have confirmation that what I've chased clear across Europe is actually real. That's encouraging anyway. But I just feel so frustrated. I keep running and running after this thing, and I never seem to get any closer.
But you have gotten all there is to be gained in Istanbul, yes?
I'm afraid so.
Giancarlo stood abruptly.
Well then, you are off duty. Is it not time to relax and put your troubles aside? This is a beautiful city, full of history that you are uniquely qualified to appreciate. At least let me show some of it to you and take your mind off your troubles.
Anya stood to join him.
Sure. That sounds wonderful.
That evening, Anya and Giancarlo rested their weary legs in a pleasantly upscale Turkish restaurant.
In 1534, the Sultan Suleiman heard that the young widow of the Count of Fundi was the most beautiful woman in all Europe. She was also renowned for her wit and erudition, although it is possible these mattered less to the Sultan. So he sent his great corsair, Captain Barbarossa, to kidnap her. They attacked in the middle of the night. As her family retainers battled to hold them off, she leapt on a horse, rode down several would-be abductors, and galloped off to safety in her nightgown.
A woman after my own heart.
Through the great window beside the couple, the fabled ancient city tumbled down to the water. Its lights made jeweled streaks across the slowly rippling waters of the Golden Horn. With Giancarlo as her laughing, knowledgeable, and attentive guide, they took in the sights of the great ancient city. Anya had thoroughly enjoyed being a tourist for the day. Anya felt a strange vibration. She frowned, wondering if she were somehow getting dizzy. Then she noticed ice tinkling and glasses and silverware rattling. A French tourist couple across the dimly lit restaurant looked around in wild-eyed dismay. A middle-aged Japanese couple sitting near Giancarlo and Anya continued eating without paying visible attention. Anya smiled and tried to relax back into her chair, although her hand was not altogether steady, setting her lamb kebab down into its bed of rice.
I'm not used to earthquakes. I guess that comes from growing up in New Orleans and now living in New York. They're what you'd call pretty seismically stable, and I've never really experienced them much on digs.
Giancarlo grinned back. His dark eyes gleamed. The lashes were long, almost feminine. Yet they didn't distract from his unmistakably masculine appeal. Rather the opposite. Something Anya was becoming more and more uncomfortably aware of as she passed time in his company.
A tremor. Hardly an earthquake by Turkish standards. Turkey is terribly afflicted with earthquakes, you may be aware. The great tsunami of 1509 overrode the seawall and killed 10,000 people.
Let's hope these shocks stay more modest, at least while we're here. Oh dear, I guess that sounds selfish.
It sounds eminently sensible. More wine?
No, thanks. I'm not really much of a drinker. I'm surprised to find alcohol so readily available in a Muslim country.
The Turks have long had a reputation for their relaxed interpretation of Islam. And of course, the country's been officially secular since the 1920s. Although that could change in an eye blink, the way things go these days.
You're very knowledgeable about Turkey.
I feel a great affinity for Istanbul. Much history has passed through here. Passed through that great harbor out there.
Much cruelty, too, it would seem. As much before the Ottomans conquered the city as after.
You speak of the Byzantines with their blindings and other Baroque punishments. To be sure. But was there ever a ruler more justly named magnificent than Suleiman? A cruel man, claro. But a scholar, a warrior, a patron of the arts. There's so little of splendor in our present age, isn't there?
I suppose so. Maybe that's why I spend so much time burrowing into the past myself.
As they walked a promenade, Anya's arm had threaded into the crook of Giancarlo's. She kept meaning to disengage it.
That story you told me over dinner, about Suleiman sending raiders to kidnap that Italian countess, was that real? That actually happened?
Ah, but yes. The woman in question was Giulia Colonna, of a great and famous family. To forget I am Italian, would I lie about such a thing? To a fellow archaeologist and historian to boot? Not to mention a woman herself notable for both beauty and intellect.
Thank you. And no, I suppose not. It just seems too melodramatic to have taken place in reality. Like the stories I read when I was a girl. I'd get enthused about them, and then the sisters would tell me they never happened and never could happen. Since then, I've kind of collected stories like that from history to prove to myself that adventures really are real. Listen to yourself. You carry the sword of a martyred French saint, and you need proof there's such a thing as adventure?
But Giancarlo's handsome face had set. He lifted his chin, stopped, turned to face her in the light of the crescent moon rising over the plateau behind them. He gripped her arm. Anya wondered if he was going to kiss her. She carefully refrained from wondering whether she would let him.
I fear I have a more disturbing tale for you now, Anya. I hope you will forgive me for not telling you before. But you seem so distraught by your misadventure in the museum that I hadn't the heart until you had time to recover.
What do you mean?
Professor Gendron has been murdered. She was found shot to death in her office with a .40 caliber handgun.
Anya turned to the ancient weathered parapet. She was scarcely aware of breaking free of his double grasp, strong though it was. A .40 caliber handgun, trademark of Easy Unguenya. She walked a few blind steps, stopped when the wall's rough stone wrapped her knees. She felt as if she were encapsulated in a glass bubble, around which seethed a storm of emotions. Rage, grief, fear, and self-reproach. First, Sir Sidney Hazelton. Now, Isabelle Gendron. Anya shook her head and forced herself back into the present moment, horrible as it had become. The news of this second murder was like an amputation in her soul. Especially since she could not avoid the guilty certainty that she, Anya Creed, was the reason that Isabel had been murdered. She suddenly found herself in Giancarlo's arms, felt long, surprisingly strong fingers grip her chin and lift her face upward. His lips touched hers. For a moment, she yielded to his kiss, then she turned away. Giancarlo stiffened. From the corner of her eye, she could see a hurt expression on his handsome face in the amber glow of a distant street lamp.
I'm sorry.
She stood and took a few steps away, unable to think of anything but Easy Unguenya. There was no question. She was locked in a contest with a cold-hearted murderer.
At least let me help you.
I wish I could, Giancarlo. But I don't want to put you in the crosshairs, too. What if I already have? Have I let Unguenya get too big a lead on me?
Anya was finally on a plane that was actually taking her to Bangkok. She'd been able to get an early morning flight out of Istanbul on Turkish Airlines. Unfortunately, that went no farther than the capital, Ankara. It seemed no flights left the country from Istanbul. Then, for some reason, the only way to Bangkok was through Germany, far to the northwest, the opposite direction from where she wanted to go. She flew to Frankfurt, where she had to hustle to catch a Royal Brunei flight leaving for Bangkok little more than an hour later. She considered herself quite fortunate to have snagged a desirable window seat directly aft of the jumbo jet's midship exit, where she could stretch her long legs instead of riding with her knees up under her chin, as she so often found herself doing. 11 hours later, 7 a.m. Bangkok time, bungee cords couldn't have kept her in that seat. Customs was the usual ordeal of searches, questions, and metal detectors, no worse or better than anywhere else in the world. The most significant difference was that the Thai customs officers were somewhat more cordial to foreign tourists than their English or American counterparts. Anya left everything but a light day pack in a locker at the airport. A taxi to the riverfront was pricey, but nothing compared to the cost of the short-notice plane ticket. She could have bought the whole taxi for that. Anya could almost hear Rue complaining. They were really going to need the commission the mysterious collector was willing to pay. But for Anya, it was no longer about the money, if it had ever been. Bangkok was called the Venice of Asia, along with a lot of less complimentary names. It was veined with canals, and its whole existence centered on Chao Phraya, the great green waterway that ran through the middle of the country. Anya had the driver let her off at an open-air market a few blocks from the waterfront so she could buy some bottled water, fruit with rinds, and packaged snacks. She didn't want a chance getting laid out with dysentery by eating food prepared by vendors. It would be hard enough to catch Easy Unguenya before she could rob the Temple of the Elephant of whatever artifacts it held, and quite possibly leave more dead bodies in her wake. Then she found a riverboat, basically an outsized canoe with a rounded roof and an engine, and engaged passage upriver to Nakhon Sawan. The railroad had run that way for over a century, and reasonably modern highways connected the city to the national capital, but water travel was quicker, especially since Anya would bet both the trains and the buses stopped frequently, and often at random, and was the least uncomfortable option. Slipping under the shade of the low, rounded roof, Anya slid her pack under the bench and settled against the gunwale. The thick air almost tasted of river water, marine fuel, and raw sewage. The craft set out into the great sluggish flow, wallowing slightly in waves reflected from the bank. Once it got out in the stream and underway, the water's slow rhythms were soporific, and the engine noise became white noise, blocking out other sounds. Anya had slept on the flight, but that never seemed to rest her. Barely feeling the discomfort of the surroundings, she huddled in upon herself and fell sound asleep. By mid-afternoon, they reached their destination. The city of Nakhon Sawan, capital of the province of the same name, lay near where the rivers Nan and Ping converge to form the arterial Chao Phraya. The riverfront gave her mostly the impression of stacks of huge teak logs, the region's main resource, lying or being loaded onto barges. Anya found a cabbie who demonstrated some grasp of English and hired him as guide as well as driver. The guide's name was Pran. He knew about the Red Monastery. He drove Anya out of town to a graveled lot in the midst of a stand of tall hardwoods he told her weren't teak. He was a skinny, middle-aged man without much of a chin and a sort of loose-jointed look. He seemed cheerful, but did not blessedly insist on chattering. He answered her questions readily enough. Mostly, he seemed to go along in his own little world. Fortunately, he was not so immersed in it that he drove alarmingly. Stepping out into the slanting, mellowing light of late afternoon, Anya was once again struck by the difference even the wind of passage through the car's open windows made. Walking through the humid air felt like wading through a swimming pool, but with more bugs. Anya saw a little mystery to why this was called the Red Monastery. Rather than the massive stone piles she usually saw in pictures or documentaries about Southeast Asian temples, this place had been built out of native hardwoods. It was enameled in a scarlet that was as bright and startling as fresh blood, even in light well diluted by angle and long tree shadows. Where it wasn't red, it was gilded, like the heads of ceremonial guardian dragons carved into the beam ends. The doors opened at their approach. A large-bellied monk in a scarlet robe over a saffron undershirt stood with sandaled feet splayed far apart. A gaggle of younger, thinner monks wearing yellow robes hung behind him. They gazed in seeming amazement at the tall foreign woman. But the head monk, or at least senior monk on duty, wasn't impressed. His scowl and head shake were universal language.
Am I too late?
Anya wasn't thinking as clearly as she should with stress and travel. It had slipped her mind that the monastery might reasonably impose visiting hours.
Tell him I'm not just a tourist. I'm an archaeologist, a scientist. I'd like to spend a few minutes examining some of their relics. I'll be no trouble.
She began fumbling in her pack. She had come well-credentialed with a letter of introduction from a prominent Columbia University professor and various documents attesting to her status as an archaeologist in good standing.
Zhao Megali! Okbai! Tom Lai! Zhao Megali!
For once, Pran's sunny disposition clouded.
It's not that.
Please tell him I'm a consultant for Chasing History's Monsters. The American television show.
No, Missy. Problem is no woman allowed. This monastery, you see?
Whether she saw or not, she couldn't misunderstand the heavy door slammed in her face. Anya stood before the blazing red door with a smiling Buddha and sinuous Thai characters embossed on it in gold, feeling foolish.
Oh.
She felt no outrage. Although, like most modern nations, Thailand made a great show of celebrating women's rights, Asia remained thoroughly patriarchal, which, in Anya's observation and research, meant that in reality the women ran everything, albeit behind the scenes, without official or acknowledged power. Besides, Anya was a foreign woman. If she stormed into town and complained to the authorities, they'd hear her out, smiling and nodding. Then they'd do nothing. She stood a moment to take careful stock of her surroundings. This wasn't Triple Canopy Rainforest. The tall, thick, bold trees stood widely spaced, with plenty of undergrowth between, and they grew close by the great, weeping-eaved structure. Her guide stood by, looking as if his pet guppy had just died.
All right then, Pran. Surely they can't object if I take some photos of the outside of their monastery with my digital camera.
Pran seemed to reinflate, his skinny shoulders rising and squaring.
No!
Apparently, he'd had some experience with Westerners who had an exaggerated sense of their own importance.
So, now I'm going to wander around outside and snap some shots. Then do you think you can find me a nice hotel in town?
Oh, yes, Miss Anya. For you, double nice.
With Pran's help, Anya got rapidly ensconced in a reasonably clean and reasonably cheap hotel. She immediately downloaded her photos of the monastery to her notebook computer and reviewed them while sitting cross-legged on the bed. Then she showered and changed and treated herself to a very good dinner. By the time dinner was finished, she had worked out what she thought was a decent plan of attack. The doors to the monastery all looked forbiddingly solid behind their frequently replenished lacquer coats. However, like many roofs on traditional Thai structures, the one on the main temple structure was compound. Between the upper roof of red fired clay tiles and a lower roof ran a row of windows. These looked to be about 2 feet by three and were clearly opened for ventilation. As far as Anya could tell, they weren't screened. The monastery compound contained a whole cluster of buildings, including dorms and storage structures. Some butted right up against the tall main building.
There's my way in.
Back in her room, she dressed in her best stealth outfit. Then went out and putted away into the hot tropical night on the little Honda scooter she'd rented with the help of a well-tipped hotel clerk after Pran dropped her off. The monastery lay half a mile or so up a dirt turnoff from the river highway. Anya hid her bike in dense undergrowth 100 yards off the main road and hiked up the dirt path. At first glimpse of the few pale lights from the monastery, Anya ditched off into the underbrush. The monastery had been built on a slight rise, probably just high enough to keep it from flooding when the Chao Phraya got frisky. The ground around it was mostly solid. That was a relief. Wading through swamps wasn't her favorite thing to do in the world. Clad head to foot in the darkest long clothing she'd packed, Anya lurked in the bushes 40 yards from the Red Monastery. Nighttime meant prime time for the loudest, most aggressively hungry creatures, especially bugs. She particularly noticed the bugs because they managed to bite her even through the long sleeves and pants. However, she was grateful for the cacophony the insects and tree frogs produced. She could go in wearing jingle bells and tap shoes, and it was unlikely anybody'd notice. Nevertheless, when she slipped from cover, she tried to move as noiselessly as possible, if for no other reason than to keep herself in the proper state of mind. She was a tall white woman who spoke not a word of Thai, out here on the verge of a great reeking swamp far away from anything but the Forbidden Monastery. She was going to be suspicious as hell to anyone who spotted her, no matter what she did. Of course, crouching in humid darkness with thorns sticking into her right thigh and something sucking the blood out of her left earlobe, preparing to commit criminal trespass, didn't exactly top her favorites playlist either. She drew a deep breath and sucked in at least one unfortunate gnat. Bent almost double, she slipped from the saw-edged foliage as quietly as she could. She half ran to a structure protruding from the backside of the main hall, like some sort of growth, away from view of the road. Climbing up a tree growing right alongside it, she walked along a big branch, using smaller ones for handholds, right onto the substructure's roof. Its steeply pitched tiles were glazed ceramic and slick as wet glass. But their flared, knobby ends provided traction of a sort. From there, she proceeded up onto the main roof's lower course and began to work her way gingerly around. She held on to the upper course tiles, although they provided little purchase to stop her from falling a dozen feet onto hard-packed clay if she lost her footing. Thanks to Google, she knew the statue she sought stood in a side chamber toward the back of the temple, near the main altar with its traditional large seated Buddha. At what she hoped was the right spot, she hunkered down and peered inside. She saw a wide space lit dimly with the wavering yellow glow of oil lamps. She slid inside, being careful to keep her feet on the base of the window frame. Shutters to keep out the rain hung beneath, presumably to be pushed shut with long poles when necessary. The last thing she needed was to put weight on one, have it give way, and have the whole monastery come running to find her lying on the floor of their sanctum with her leg broken. It was farther to the floor than she expected, perhaps 10 feet. She let herself hang from a lower corner of the window frame by one hand and dropped. Her long, strong legs flexed, easily taking up the shock. She put a hand on the floor to help support her in a crouch and listened. Her rubber-soled shoes hadn't made much noise hitting the polished hardwood floor. Straining her senses, Anya heard nothing, felt no vibration transmitted through the wood to her fingertips. She seemed to have the hall to herself. The air within hung thick and still. Keen incense sliced the humid air. She smelled the pungent oil used on the floors and mustiness lingering from sweaty monk's robes. A quick survey took in an altar with its big golden Buddha to her right, illuminated from beneath by brass lamps whose tiny, flickering yellow flames made the seated figure's plump, benign face seem disconcertingly alive. Alcoves lined the walls, each containing its own figure, and lit by a single lamp. Anya doubted any of them was her guy, Avalokiteshvara. None was wider than her palm. Not for the first time, she wondered why anyone would bother to scrawl a map on the bottom of a statue in some obscure monastery in a swamp in the Thai Central Plains. No doubt von Heunigen had explained how that came to pass in his journals, which were stereotypically meticulous. Maybe he even explained how he happened to find out about the map. But either those journals had gone to the bottom of the Bosporus, like von Heunigen himself, or succumbed to water damage after the torpedo attack, also like von Heunigen. Anya straightened and moved forward. She walked carefully, placing the lead foot fully on the floor before beginning to transfer weight to it. She stood upright. It made balancing easier. And any monk who walked in was not going to be any less likely to spot her in the middle of the open floor if she scuttled like a spider. Stopping at the intersection, she leaned forward to look left for 3 seconds, drew back, then took a peek right. To her left ran a hallway, lit by a faint gleam from somewhere. Its steadiness betrayed its electronic origin. A short step led up. A door opened beside it, presumably to a rectory or some other kind of office. To Anya's right lay a small chamber. In the midst of it, upon a waist-high pedestal of gleaming, polished teak, danced the many-armed figure she recognized from her research as Avalokiteshvara. She entered the chamber, stepping quickly to the side so that anyone walking through the main hall wouldn't spot her. She studied the statue. It was about 2 feet high and gleamed gold in the light of a small overhead electric light in a recessed niche, as well as 8 oil lamps placed on the octagonal pedestal around it. The statue's base was the size of a dinner plate, sufficient for a compressed treasure map. Of course, if the statue were solid gold, it could weigh 50 or 60 pounds or more. Anya tried it. As she hoped, it was hollow. Likely it was also some other metal, possibly bronze, cast as thin as feasible and then gold washed. It was still very heavy, but Anya found the weight manageable. She tipped the object to the side. She was able to hold it in the crook of her right arm as she crouched to examine the base. To her exhilarated surprise, the map was clearly visible. A quick inspection by the light of her digital camera, held in her left hand, suggested the inscription had been gouged with some kind of fine, sharp tool, then inked. The ink had aged and fallen out in places, but the map seemed mostly legible. Her quick examination showed a legend in, of all things, French. She snapped a couple of images. Then she tucked her camera away in a cargo pocket of her long pants so she could lower the icon from its pedestal to the floor. She intended to examine it carefully, to memorize the details, then replace it. It wouldn't take more than 5 minutes, and then she'd be gone.
Kunmen Krai!
Huh?
At the entry to the alcove, a wizened, bent man in scarlet stood holding a flashlight. Flanking him were 4 younger acolytes in saffron robes. They carried staffs in their hard brown hands.
Just leaving.
Anya smiled and nodded in what she hoped was harmless affability. She started to tip the heavy statue back onto its plinth.
Pugukruk!
Oh, boy.
The yellow-robed acolytes came for her. One of the monks whacked her on the shoulder with his staff.
Ow! Hey, I thought you Buddhists were pacifists!
The young man grinned at her. The expression suggested he understood her meaning perfectly, even if he didn't grasp the words. She rolled the heavy statue toward him.
Catch!
He dropped his staff to catch the relic. Anya darted past him. His partner held his staff horizontally to bar her way. Anya kicked up, caught the hardwood staff painfully on her shin, knocked it into the air right out of the startled monk's grasp. He blinked and drew back. She shouldered him out of the way. As she ran out into the main nave, another monk cracked her sharply on the shins with his staff. She tripped, but managed to tuck her shoulder and roll. It wasn't exactly a neat and graceful roll. She landed heavily on her back, blasting the air out of her as she skidded clear across the floor to fetch up against the far wall. The great hall's imposing double front doors had been flung open. More monks poured in. They clutched not only staffs, but nasty, curved swords. Anya managed to snap to her feet quickly, if not quite gracefully. Still more monks were pouring into the hall from the corridor across from Avalokiteshvara's alcove.
Yikes!
She spun. A monk was rushing her from behind with his staff raised in both hands. She sidekicked him in the gut. The monk went flying back, colliding with the half a dozen monks behind him. Anya used the momentum to dash right at the monks streaming in the doors. Thinking fast, she had formed a plan. The charging monks raised staffs to smite the infidel. Anya dropped and slid into them sideways. Anya slid across the slick floor into the shins of 3 of them. Since they kept charging, they obligingly tripped right over her. She came upright, nose to nose, with a startled acolyte. She plucked the staff out of his shock-weakened grasp and wrapped him across the nose with it. He promptly fell down, clutching his face. 2 of his buddies tripped over him. Anya sidestepped them neatly. The angry, organized monks were now confused, milling monks. It was too good to last. They were all around now, so she held the quarterstaff by one end like a bat. She was mainly trying to make it whistle menacingly and keep the mob back, but she wasn't afraid to make it connect. The monks gave way, but the momentary disorder was quickly turning into focused anger. Anya tucked the staff under an armpit and turned, holding her other hand out stiffly. It was a move she'd seen in Hong Kong martial arts flicks. It did seem to have the effect of encouraging the monks to keep a respectful distance, for the moment. Turning to face the main door, she saw through the crowd the ferociously scowling face of the abbot who had turned her away in the first place. It was time for Plan B. Too bad there never had been a Plan A.